Welcome to the One Within All to another episode of the Innerverse podcast. And I've been looking forward to this conversation since December. Tonight, we're going to go further into demonstrating what we've been talking about for many months. This idea of Lumashi, as it was known to the ancient Babylonian or Sumerian culture, the constellation writing, the scripture of the stars that the scribes of the priesthood have been, you know, we see all the time these poets that are somehow also historians. How is that? Why is that? It's because what the ancient history is really referring us to is this starry, stellar tableau of many, many, many possible variations of mixed up archetypes and miracle stories, really. So back in December, we had John McHugh on the podcast to talk about the nativity of the New Testament, why and how we got the two different stories of Jesus's birth in the book of Matthew and Luke, why they were different, where the details came from. Was a really, really good conversation. Today, we're going to get into a subject that I find to be possibly the most fascinating aspect of the entire astrotheology, which is the Pegasus constellation and how it has morphed throughout mythologies to become everything from the river ocean to the tablet that the Quran is written upon. The Ark, both as a boat and as a box, the Garden of Eden, and so much more. This celestial square in the sky tells quite a few stories, and it's going to be fascinating for John to break it down for us and show how the cuneiform writing of the ancient Sumerian and Akkadian cultures is where potentially, or maybe one of the oldest sources, maybe not the original, but definitely one of the oldest sources of this particular scripture and all the different details going on with it. So make sure that you're if you really like this, make sure that you pick up The Celestial Code of Scripture by John McHugh. You can find it linked in the show notes for this episode. It's probably on Amazon. You can also get it straight from his publisher. I've had a great time with this book. I reread the chapters pertinent to the conversation today. Enjoyed that quite a bit. There's so much on the table. If only every guest was as well prepared with a PowerPoint as John is for us tonight, we're going to have so much fun. And, you know, just a little bit of John's background before we jump in. He was raised Catholic, found that Christian mythos to be his pathway to the sacred, deeply spiritual guy working in a very highly atheistic field, which is, you know, archaeoastronomy. He was telling me before we got on, the word astrotheology is like not even allowed in some circles there. And so to be able to come on with us to the black belt level course and go deep beyond the surface level of his knowledge and his research, I think he and I are both going to have a lot of fun. Thank you, everyone who's here live. Please help us out. Share the show to whoever you know that might like this deep gnosis. And with all that being said, can't wait to get into it. Welcome back to the podcast, John. Thanks for being here, man.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, Chance. And thank you so much for letting me be on Innerverse again. I look forward to just sharing some information that I've been working on for the past, I guess, decade. Well, actually more than a decade, but that has been published in various peer-reviewed scholarly journals and then eventually made it into the book. But it's connected to Pegasus, and you know, everybody wants... Even the youngest child, once they find out about a flying horse named Pegasus, they fall in love with it. But the history of Pegasus might be more intriguing and far more serious than a child's toy. And I hope we can dip into that. So I also want to say to you, as I said to you before we went on, in the streams I swim in with astronomers all around me and linguists all around me, they're mostly atheists. And I'm very spiritual. My language to the sacred is Catholic, but I connect to all of it. Paganism, I connect to Islam, I connect to Judaism, I connect to Buddhism, with all forms of European paganism, Wicca. And but the language, the lingo is just Catholic, but it's the same language in whatever spiritual tradition you feel most comfortable in. There's similarities all over. So having said that, I'm so glad to be here, and I was wondering if we can just go right into the I made a PowerPoint for the viewers. I thought they might like it.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for that. And for everyone that's catching the replay and they're listening to the audio RSS feed of the show, I think you'd get more out of it if you popped over to the YouTube or the Rockfin, Odyssey, BitChute, wherever you might want to see the, you know, screen that John's going to be putting up for us here. His PowerPoints are very well done. But I do think you'll be able to get the gist of what we're talking about just listening. But, you know, consider this your invitation to jump onto the video. And if you aren't checking out the live shows when they're live, there's such a vibrant community here that I see them all chatting, saying nice and supportive and fun things to each other. Everybody's getting it. Super high amount of love here. Now, what what you just said, though, before we jump into your slides, I do want to, but I like to reiterate this point lately, how we may often in this show, and me particularly, put a lot of emphasis on the sameness between all these different systems and mythologies. Now, that doesn't make it doesn't invalidate the uniqueness of any particular culture's expression of the mysteries, the morality, the aesthetic, you know, the cultural difference in terms of what you have to do to survive in one part of the world versus another. There's plenty of difference and variation in all of that. But I think when we get down to the core of like, what is the mythology coming from? It's the Sky Father. It's the almost the fractality of the as above, so below alchemical idea that you can see the whole sky at once. And in some strange way, it becomes a technology to access our innate capacity to know things as spiritual creatures, as children of our creator or the universe, or however you like to conceptualize that. So if every being has access to the same as above, I mean, not completely the same, different regions of the world see different constellations. Yes, but there is this wholeness aspect to the sky that really does connect all of us. And it gives us a navigatory capacity through the world and through our psyche, more than just the ability to get on a boat and know where you're at in the middle of the wide ocean. This as above is a technological language. I mean, technology means language originally before it was applied to electronics. It is the technology of the sacred. These are the terms of art for probing the depths of our inner world. And in that sense, the inner world, the all is one, is in some degree going to be the same and syncretizable to all peoples everywhere, because we share more in common than we have different. It just is what it is.
Yeah.
You can paint a million paintings, but it's always going to be the same 7-color palette. And that's humanity. So excited to get into your slides, man. But you, if you want to respond to that before I bring them up, that's all good.
Yeah, no, it's so true. There's a ubiquitous spiritual connection between all of us. It's just inherent. And all human beings looked at the same stars. Now, they may have given them different names. And as you talked about, living in different parts of the world with different seasonality, rainy seasons, dry seasons, deserts, rainforests, they may have had different uses in different cultures, and the constellation titles may be different, but the same practice of looking at the divine in the stars is ubiquitous to all human beings.
I love it. Yeah. Are we going to start with the Iku constellation, or are we going to start with some Easter stuff?
Yeah. I got it all weaved in, if you don't mind.
Okay, beautiful. All right. I'm just going to let you take it away and try not to interrupt too much.
Yeah. So you were fascinated with, back when I got your email, you were fascinated with the Iku constellation, which I am. But it's involved in so many different, you know, myths, religious myths. And, you know, remember, myths is a modern term in a scientific world. If you were part of the culture, you would have believed that story at least having an archetypal truth, if not a literal truth. But there's so many connections to the Iku constellation. It's called the Pegasus Square, that I could barely fit it in on the title. So I'm like, Iku, how the sacred celestial field morphed into a flying horse, a river god that encircles the earth, the Garden of Eden, Noah's Ark, and a celestial tablet named Al-Quran.
And that's just the greatest hits.
There's more, but we'll leave them out, you know. So
hey, John, real quick, I want to tell you something too. This is alive and well still today. I happened to rewatch the film Avengers the first one, the Marvel comics.
Yeah.
The very beginning of the film, they're dealing with this Tesseract, which is like a fourth dimensional hypercube that gives the wielder godlike powers and all that. Well, the secret intelligence agency program where they're working on this Tesseract cube square is called the Pegasus Project.
Oh, well, there you go.
It's like somebody knows in Hollywood.
Somebody knows is right. Yeah. Well, maybe they're watching. So, having said that, I do want to touch on, of course, it's in the, I got to plug this thing for Monkfish.
Plug it.
Yeah. So it's a Celestial Code of Scripture. The subtitle is The Astral Cipher Underlying the Miracle Stories of the Bible and the Quran. It just basically shows that the stories that we call, we recorded as miracles in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and pagan religious mythology actually have templates as pictures in the stars. When you look at the earliest titles, which is cuneiform, cuneiform is a very polysemous script. Every cuneiform sign has different readings and means different words. When you write down all the meanings, you get all the myths. They just start showing up, and you're like, "Whoa, this is the original hard drive of scriptures." Is the only way I can describe it, you know, it's what it feels like. So, but
yeah, you can't really understate the polysemy,
polysemy, the multiple
meanings in the cuneiform is, you know, we have that in English, but we're talking to a degree of magnitude, like a factor of 10 compared to the English, how one word might mean lots of different things depending on context in English. Yeah. It's like, you know, dial that up to the max with cuneiform.
Yeah, and that's the hardest part of this presentation. I'm going to do everything I can to not be boring, okay, and pedantic. So I'm going to zip through it and try to be as, you know, chatty as possible. But I don't have analogies in English, and that's the dilemma. We just don't write in and communicate in an alphabetic script the way Sumerians, Babylonians, and Assyrians did in cuneiform. So, but before we do that, I just wanted to point something out. We're coming up on Easter, and I'm not trying to get denominational here at all, but, you know, I don't think people realize that Easter is celebrated on the first Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox. It's about as pagan as you can get. Because you know, my other specialty is Native American rock art. So when I go in the field as an archaeologist, I'm almost always either documenting or analyzing Native American pictographs and petroglyphs for celestial meaning connected to solstice alignments, equinox alignments, and other calendrical important dates. Especially the main culture I study are what's called the Fremont people. Today we call them the ancestral Pueblo. And in some books that you've read, you may have heard of them as the Fremont or the Anasazi, a little bit further south. But anyway, so I just, because I'm around sacred petroglyphs all the time, so there's these calendrical times when you have these hierophanies on Earth, and when these, it's a hierophany is when the sacred manifests itself, numinous God, whatever word you want to use for that, manifests on Earth in front of you. And you see it frequently at certain moments throughout the year. And there's you can see a pictograph there from about 1000 AD in near Dinosaur National Monument. And there's a Zuni Pueblo sun priest, and there's a picture of a kiva there, which is basically an underground church for the Pueblo Indians. They're the main peoples I study. But so celestial hierophanies are like, they're calendrical moments when the divine is present with us on Earth. That's the summer solstice. So this headdress of this pictograph, it's about 1000 years old, lights up. And this is a non-literate culture, and it lights up at the summer solstice. You know, it's clearly marking the summer solstice, and there's a picture of it right there. But so it's what we often overlook today, especially in this, you know, very secular world we live in. It's these moments when when human prayers are amplified. So if you're trying to build something, create something special in your spirit, in your heart, in your relationship, in your family, in your friends, in your work, you might want to pay attention to these times. And here's an example. So this marks the turning point of the sun at the winter solstice. This is at Fremont Indian State Park. You can see a dual sun right there. It's a little moon down to the right, crescent moon. But it's marking the winter solstice. You had to turn the sun god the winter solstice or everyone would freeze to death. That's what Stonehenge's main purpose was, praying to the sun, being present with the sun and saying, hey, we need you to turn now. Please, we beg you.
They considered it an entirely different sun.
Yeah. Yeah. The Pueblo Indians don't consider it a different sun, but they know that this time of the year is crucial to do the proper prayers so that the sun continues to move in its pattern. If it goes out of balance, we're all done.
I want to make a quick commentary on hierophanies, that word, just to help people understand it a little bit, because it's a 50 cent word. They probably never seen it.
Right? Yeah, so you have hierophany. Yeah, hierophany. It just means when the sacred manifests in the human world, in the physical world in front of you, you can see it. And you're looking at one right there in that pictograph. We call it this. The solstice god is all we could come up with. We don't know the language of the Fremont people. I've got some inklings as to what it was, but that is one. And actually, we did it. I'm the lead archaeologist for the Utah Cultural Astronomy Project, and that's my other life. I do nothing but Native American rock art. So that might be a future show.
But it has to be.
Yeah. So,
but Hydro is like the word hero or Eros. So that's usually the being that is the savior, deity, son of God, who does typically in the mythos manifest in a human form. And then the fannies at the end, the second half, the fan or the fin, that's like the same idea as like profane, the phantom or the phanum is the temple. So profane would be outside the temple, but that fan, P-H-A-N or F-A-N, it shows up, that's a linguistic root to pay attention for. You'll see it in Finn or like in the Irish and Celtic, the Fenians was what they called the Phoenicians who were sailing around and giving all these ideas around. So the Phoenicians, the fawn of Phoenicians is also similar idea. Just wanted to help people understand that word a little bit. You have Eros and then fan. So it's like the holy Eros or savior in a way.
Yeah. And it's right in front of you. It's manifest in front of you. And I go to this site every year, for obvious reasons, but, somebody just wrote in the chat that it means sun. And that's an appropriate term. I think of soul as sun, but that's Latin.
There's a lot in the words for the most important celestial object. And it's got like the phoenix. Phoenix is obviously a solar symbol of that equinoctial resurrection and all that. So it's got the same root in it as well. But we don't have to hang up on that. I know you have a lot of slides. I like that word and I wanted to spend a moment on it.
Please. Yeah, no, it was wonderful. You did. And so, so there's a turning of the sun at the winter solstice. And, these had to go through. I'm not just making this up. Like, these had to go through peer review and everything. This one was in American Indian Rock Art from like 2021. Did an article on it. I also want to emphasize the sacred direction. So, we think of north, south, east, and west. In the Native American world, the directions are sacred, and they're not exactly north, south, east, west as we see them. They're northeast, southeast, southwest and northwest, and they connect with the summer solstice sunrise, summer solstice sunset, the equinoxes, and then the winter solstice sun. Mostly it's those sunrise and sunsets at the solstices. They were the boundary lines of the sacred. When you did your prayers in Native American spiritual belief. So, and here's a picture of a kiva. It's basically an underground ceremonial church. in the Pueblo Indian religion. The Pueblo Indians, they live along the Rio Grande now, and you've got the Hopi Mesas, you have Zuni Pueblo, Acoma Pueblo. So most of them build kivas, these circular semi-underground. When you see a circular structure and it's partially underground, it's very likely it's kiva. You enter and leave from a ladder. And so even when they make their altars on the floor in those kivas, they're aligning them to the summer solstice, sunrise, sunset, winter solstice, sunrise, sunset. So what I'm suggesting is when you do your prayers, you might want to make that alignment to amplify your prayers for people in the universe who do offerings and try to connect with the sacred. And again, the other suggesting prayer times, Native Americans always pray to the rising. Any traditional Native American does a little prayer and offering at sunrise and at sunset. And if you can, when it's directly overhead, we would call it, astronomically, we call it solar noon.
The juice is right there in the middle. That's why the Savior of the Trinities is the mediator between the God the Father and mankind. Mediator means the middle. So those moments of liminal transitional space, sunset, sunrise, are right in the middle of the day, solar noon. Those are symbolically, you know, you have more of a shot of getting a word in through the mediator.
yeah, exactly. And they, Native Americans, actually do major rituals at, they call bringing down the sun when it's directly overhead. They're trying to bring down the sacred when you have that power coming at its most forceful, and it's in between its rising point, its setting point, like you just said, Chance. Again, it's trying to align yourself with the idea that your life is connected to that picture. If that goes out of balance, it's over, you know? And I think we forget that. So I just wanted to point that out. But the other piece to it is, Native Americans, the calendar is actually kept. In fact, the crescent moon it's very much like Islam, where the visible waxing crescent moon starts the month, then it moves to full, then it moves to waning. There's the idea that if you're doing constructive work in your life, you're trying to build something, you want to do your prayers during a waxing moon towards full. Praying for the 2 days during the 2 days of the full moon is often great for any kind of fertility or fecundity. And then if you're trying to get rid of something or jettison something or destroy something about yourself that you don't like, then you want to do your prayers in a waning, towards a waning crescent, as the moon's getting smaller and it starts appearing over the eastern horizon. So notice I put little moons there right on the outsides of the summer solstice and the winter solstice. So about every 18.61 years, the moon usually, so if you woke up and you watched the sun at the summer solstice, you'd see it rise, go to the winter solstice, come back in 365 days. Well, the moon has a cycle too, but the cycle is 18.61 years. So, and there's a small period of time every 18.61 years when the moon actually rises and sets beyond the limits of the sun, about 5 degrees north and about 5 degrees south. It's called the major lunar standstill. And there it is over Chimney Rock in southwestern Colorado. That's the rising moon. I think this is 2006 was the last time we had a major lunar standstill. That Pueblo, which was built in like around 1050 AD, the Pueblo there is meant to align and make it align with this event. So at Fremont Indian State Park, where I happen to do a lot of work in Utah, we found this pendant. It's only about a little bigger than a half dollar. But if you notice, it's got crescent on the right, a central hole, and then a crescent on the left. It's got 13 little, I've marked them in there for you, 13 little what look like little circles, and then 19 etchings. It's very likely that this is a lunar pendant marking the lunar phases, just like on the front of your Innerverse podcast. You know what I mean? They have the moons marked off, right? Starts on the right. Pueblo, for just to make a long story short, Pueblo people typically do their rock art right to left, almost like Hebrew and Arabic. So you have your waxing crescent, you got your full moon is the circle in the middle, and then you have your waning crescent. 13 moons is actually what occur. The beginning of a 13th moon occurs every year because the lunar cycle is 11 days shorter than the solar cycle. So every year you have 12 full lunations and then the beginning of a 13th moon, about one third of a 13th moon. And it's shown there in that pendant. And then the 19 is connected to that 19 year, the 19 years it takes to mark the major lunar standstill. So I just found that pendant really interesting. I want to share it with you.
Oh, that's it's awesome.
Yeah, and it's probably made by someone like this is the Pequen. This is Pequen just means it's the sun priest at the Zuni Pueblo from 1896. So before
I'll just say too, the right to left Boustrophedon style. Mm-hmm. It's not like evidence, but it is a point in the column of similarity to the Phoenician alphabet, and they were sailors. I mean, somebody took information around the world. I don't know who it was. We don't have a good name for that culture other than calling them holy sailors, but there's a link there.
There was a great scholar named Barry Fell from Harvard. I think he was an oceanographer, and he wrote about connections between Europe and the Middle East and that are found in America that you just don't hear about in history books. You're like, you're not going to get that published, you know. So so I just wanted to share that with you. So we've just had the vernal equinox, and so the first full moon after the vernal equinox is on April 6th and 7th. So if you're active in your prayer life and your spirit life, be a great time to do a ceremony with your family, your friends, and really try to amplify whatever you're trying to create in your life on April 6th and 7th. Trying to have a baby, great time, stuff like that. So anyway, I just want to share that with you because it matters to me. And I believe me, I don't get to talk about that in my archaeoastronomy circles. I'll never publish again.
I love it. You know, Easter is definitely a pagan thing. Just that word. Like, I know that you're hip to some of the ways that letters don't necessarily have a one-to-one equivocal translation between languages. And so with the letter S, sometimes you see S become S-T as a sound. And so Easter is also like Easter or Acer or Icer. The Etruscans of Italy, pre-Roman civilization, they called the top god Icer, spelled like the same way that the Norse spell the Aesir, which is their gods. The Druids had a system of emanations from a single god that was called the Aesir. You know, so all those words are basically Easter. And then not to mention what most people connected to, Ishtar. So
yeah, that's what I was just thinking.
Goes around the whole, everywhere has got a version of this almost.
Yeah. And it's incredibly pagan. So, you know, again, if you're pagan, if you're Catholic, you're pagan. And if you're pagan, you're Catholic. And so anyway, that ubiquity of humanity and our spiritual connections, I think, is really a bond that we need to really focus more on. Instead of focusing on our differences, we need to focus on our similarities, you know. But that's what we're here to talk about tonight. There's that little box. There's our little coup, right? So this is from this is a sketch from the calendar of Dendera in Egypt. So for whatever reason, the Egyptians don't show Pegasus. They adopt the Mesopotamian zodiac that makes its way into Greece. You get Greco-Roman Egypt. In about 60 BC, they build this temple was built in about 60 BC. It was finished in the early date, like 20 AD or something like that. But you can see the square. It's a field. It's an irrigated field. It's straddled by Pisces, obviously. And it's not a flying horse. So the question then becomes, you know, how did this field, this sacred field, was what the original four stars that we call the Pegasus Square, how did it suddenly morph into a flying horse? And then we'll see that it's the Garden of Eden. It's definitely the the arc of the Gilgamesh epic flood story and the Bible. And it's also possibly the idea of where the Quran being a celestial tablet kept in heaven. It's all embedded in that constellation. And that's what I was trying to unpack tonight.
Yeah, and this is so important. Like, for example, people have brought up in Greece, you can't see Canopus, who is like the navigator of the Argo constellation, which is usually where people point and say that's the Ark. But as with everything astrotheological, there's redundancy built in. You know, maybe you don't see a certain constellation in one part of the world, but they have a version of it encoded somewhere else. It's like redundancies is the best way I could describe it. So, like, I, you know, after reading your work and seeing how well it syncretizes with other research, the Iku field being the Ark actually in a lot of ways is more fitting than the constellation that is currently called Argo, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, that's the whole flood story is a whole nother. That was my master's thesis. I think it was called the Biblical Deluge, a mythical event projected onto the constellation, or a historic event projected onto the constellations. I'm not Mormon, but I went to Brigham Young University because they have a great Native American studies program, and they also have a great linguistic program. So I got to do both. And but they made me say a historic event projected onto the constellations because that event in Christian belief system has to be historic. It doesn't have to be a global flood, but it has to be the idea of a powerful destructive flood that was aggrandized into the story of Noah. So anyway, these are just the articles that they're, you know, they were peer reviewed, and that's how it ended up in the Celestial Code of Scripture. But the
people screenshot the list of articles if they want to find more.
If you Google search those,
you'll find them.
Yeah. So they're listed in the Celestial Code of Scripture and the bibliography at the end. But what the Celestial Code of Scripture is really doing is it's trying to expose. I don't want to sound like, you know, self-aggrandizing or anything, because I'm just a mediocre scholar, but I ask very different questions because, you know, I couldn't reconcile the historic idea of miracles and in science. I just couldn't do it until I found all this. And then I was like, oh, I see there's a whole nother system here. And so it's the idea that the constellations that we see in the sky are still frames of, you know, momentous or monumental archetypal events that once occurred on Earth. And that when you take these stellar pictures, you see pictures of miracles. And then when you write down the cuneiform titles for the constellations in each stellar tableau, those, because of the alternate readings for each cuneiform sign, you end up getting the myths that show up in the pagan world and the Judaic world and the Christian world and the Islamic world. And that's what the book's about. And so it looks like the authors of religious history are the what we would call the Magi, the Magi that show up at this and follow the star Bethlehem to the birth site of Jesus. They're Babylonian astrologers. I know a lot of people say that they're Persian, but by the time that story was written in the first century, the word magoi in Greek, or magus in Greek, it referred to a Babylonian astronomer astrologer. You're a priest. You're not just an astronomer. You're literally an interlocutor with the heavenly gods. That's what you did.
That's missing from our understanding is the way that information was flowing between these magi of different cultures. And so how I currently conceive of it is that somebody at some point, some culture, were they priests? Were they merchants? Was it some of both? Took the idea of the constellations as a sacred tool, a navigatory tool around to many different places, and then imparted the wisdom of what we would call Lumashi from the Sumerian side, the constellation writing, that there's actually a text up there and you can decode it. And that's where you can get knowledge of the world from, or wisdom from. And then different cultures took that and ran with it from there. And so they start coming up with their own myths. There's some a lot of similarities and overlap because they maybe had the same starting point or template, something like that. But then there's also this east to west thing going on the continent that is very difficult to parse out. But, you know, Mesopotamia, the word that we get for the part of the Middle East that get, where Babylon and Sumeria and Phoenicia, all of that is kind of in that area of the off the Mediterranean on the east side. Meso means middle, pot or po. Those are both names, you know, some of the 10,000 names of Buddha.
Oh, wow. Interesting. You know? Yeah.
And there's even like, there's even some accepted mainstream history regarding the Greco-Buddhist empire. How, you know, Buddhism, yeah. I won't say it's the original thing, but there's, you know, there's a lot of back and forth, like somebody taking it from Europe to the East, someone taking it from the East back to Europe and then back again. And I don't know how many times the telephone game has been played, but there is something there that, like, you know, it's Buddhism all the way down in a sense.
Yeah, interesting. There's a lot of trade between the Indus Valley in India and Mesopotamia. So that whole Indus Valley civilization in India is a really strong connection with Mesopotamia.
Another example, like the Magi were called Umanu. Is that right? Is that how you say
Umanu,
that?
Yeah, Umanu. And,
Umanu.
Yeah.
So you have Om. The sacred Om and Manu or Menu or many different variations of that word is the sacred lawgiver in so many cultures, in so many places, a version of that word, Manus, Manu, Menu, Minos, it goes on. And so like that word for Magi, Umanu is like the lawgivers of Om, you know, and that's pretty much their job description. So that's a fascinating word too
for Magi. And so that what the theory is that every culture had their own version of the Magi, and they would read their sacred history from these stellar picture stories, these archetypal stories. So I already touched on this, but the pagan narratives that are embedded in the Aku constellation have to do with Pegasus emerging from the springs of the god ocean. And, you know, the idea that the god ocean is described as a river that encircles the world. And you're like, wait, he's the ocean, but he's in river form and he circles the earth. Where'd you get that one? There's nothing on earth that looks like that. And I'll show you how they read it in the stars. And then there's other biblical stories. Tonight, we're going to talk about the Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden story. We'll talk about the ark being the Aku being the Gilgamesh epic, Tabitha 11, the flood story of Gilgamesh epic. The Ark is literally the Aku constellation. Like it says, build yourself an Aku constellation. So I'm like, okay, I think this might be a celestial myth. And then there's a claim throughout Islam that the Quran is written on a celestial tablet and kept in heaven. And I have some ideas about that I think you'll find intriguing. So there it is. So Pegasus, a flying horse whose appearance is cut off at the navel. And just so your readers are aware, when you sit and look up in the sky and you've got north at your back, south, say you're lined up north, south, Pegasus shows up so upside down. So north is the bottom of your screen. South is the top of your screen. So
if Pegasus, which can also symbolize navigating by night for a seafaring people, if it's cut off at the navel, exact same as the mythos of the ark being cut off at the prow.
Yeah. And there's other, a lot of stories in Sumeria talking about that as well. There's another constellation. I can do another show on that if you want. But anyway, so the thing that's interesting about Pegasus, he first shows up in Hesiod, about 700 BC. So he's described, you know, he's the flying horse. He springs forth from the severed head of Medusa. Perseus cuts off Medusa's head. You see it. It's a picture in the stars. It's one of our constellations. And then Pegasus flew away and left the earth and came to the deathless gods, which means Pegasus flew up into the sky. they never say anything about wings. Pegasus just flew up into the sky after getting emerging from Medusa's severed head. This is very likely because Pegasus's catasterism. Catasterism just means it's a term for placing among the stars. It explains the monumental or archetypal event that allowed a certain constellation to enter into immortality in heaven, in the celestial realm. And it's interesting to me because it's as if Hesiod also realizes that Pegasus is a constellation as he's writing in about 700 BC. And Homer doesn't mention Pegasus, but Hesiod does. And Hesiod's a late contemporary of Homer. Homer's probably between 750 and 700 BC, and Hesiod's later in that time frame. So one of the things that's interesting about Hesiod is he relies on the Babylonian epic of creation called Enuma Elish. All of his themes come right out of Enuma Elish, which is the Babylonian and Assyrian creation story. It's their epic of creation, right? Enuma Elish is definitely one of the, it's the Vade Mecum. It's a reference manual. It's a handbook of all of the Mesopotamian astrologers. They use Enuma Elish, especially Tablet 7, and I'll show you why in a sec. And so if Hesiod is relying on the themes in Enuma Elish, it presupposes that he's got some astronomical information at his fingertips that is Mesopotamian. He might even have a Mesopotamian tutor. He might even be a Mesopotamian. And we'll go into that a little bit later. But so I'm just going to go in. So not only is Pegasus born from the severed head of Medusa, but so is Krusar. It's the golden sword. He's a golden sword deity, right? And remember, Pegasus is born literally near the springs of the god Ocean. And that's where this birth occurs. So, you know, you're looking around and you're like, well, there's Mesopotamia. You can see it over there on the right. As you talked about so eloquently earlier, Phoenicia, where I circled there, is where somehow more than half of the Mesopotamian constellations show up in the Greek world. Nobody knows how. And I think I know how. And that's what the book goes in. The book goes into that a bit. But the old theory was, well, there were traders meeting up in Phoenicia and they just exchanged ideas. They exchanged, sailing techniques and constellations that they used to guide their ships. And I'm not saying that that's not how some of the constellations made it. But as you'll see in a few more slides, there's a much simpler explanation. So to get back into Mesopotamia, so Mesopotamian astrologers are one of these, we would call them magicians today, but they're a manu, they're scholars, they're experts, they are called sorcerers by the Christians and the Jews. They're called magicians as well. And they included astronomers. And when I use the term astronomer or astrologer, it's the same word. I just don't feel like saying astronomer, astrologer every time. So they're astrologers, just straight up diviners, exorcists, physicians, and lamentation chanters, the people who had to control and soothe angry gods. And when you use the term umanu, it could mean that you had one of those skills. But in reality, most umanu had all of them. They could do them all. So they knew, they were exorcists. They were physicians. They knew what herbs to give you. They knew how to, the prayers that were needed and the offerings needed to soothe angered gods, to make it rain. They could predict the future. They could predict, you know,
Well, they wanted everyone to think they could predict the future.
yeah.
They're the therapeutae Egypt, the healer, miracle workers, healers. This is literally what Christianity comes from, 100%.
Interesting. Yeah, that's true. It's definitely true. And so what's interesting about the title of an astronomer in Mesopotamia, remember, the word umanu just means expert or scholar, right? But the exact title is Tupshadu, and Tupshadu is, it literally means writer, an author is what it means. And it comes from the idea that these, they are just linguists par excellence. They control Sumerian, they control Akkadian. They probably know another language, maybe Aramaic. And they're, what they're really studying, though, is they're studying these Sumerian Akkadian dictionaries. And that's where all the polysemy shows up, the multiple meanings on a word or phrase, which is what polysemy means. It's just a thing. I like it because it's so accurate. Polysemy just means multiple meanings in a word or a phrase. And in cuneiform, it's astonishing when you see how you write in cuneiform and how polysemy starts to show up. So Tupcharu, it's an astrologer, it's an astronomer, and it literally means a writer. And so it's the idea that it comes from, the reason they're called writers is because these astrologers viewed the starry sky as heavenly writing. Shittir Shomei, Shittir Berume, Chitirti Shamami. They're just forms of celestial writing, heavenly writing, writing of the sky is how you could translate all three of those. There's a picture of the Magi going to following the star Bethlehem to Jesus' birth. But these Tupcharu, they studied and edited. They wrote, I mean, the author of the Gilgamesh epic is an exorcist, you know, which implies he knew astrology as well. They write the tale of Atrahasis, which is the earliest creation story and flood story. They write Enuma Elish, which is the Babylonian-Assyrian epic of creation. And what they're studying are these Sumerian and Akkadian dictionaries. And I'll show you what they are in a minute. But again, we all can figure out the prognostication piece. It comes from the idea that the stars can allow you to predict what's going to occur on Earth in the future. Now, we apply that horoscopically today to personally benefit ourselves. But in the ancient world, this was done to guide the king or queen, the rulers in the land that had to make the best decisions for the community.
Which is why, you know, the top king, chief of the priests, all that, they're also a judge. In the Old Testament, they're often just referred to as judges. Yep. Interestingly, judges. The word judge, you know, used to linguistically even be a definition of the word God with the lowercase g.
Yeah.
God meant magistrate, prince, judge, ruler. Yeah. So we get this term, I think a really good term for it, judicial astrology.
Yep.
But it's fascinating to consider that this was bidirectional. The future, yes, but also this is how you create the supporting foundational narrative of your quote ancient history unquote to justify the existence of your empire or your dynasty.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and that's what I try to go into. So, and that's where we start touching on the Lamashi writing. So they have this other form of writing. It's kept pretty secret. It's only mentioned by Esarhaddon, Assyrian King Esarhaddon. He's ruling around 680 BC. And he says, he's got this stone monument. And he said, I wrote my name in constellation writing. And they're like, wait, you wrote your name in constellation writing? That implies a whole system of constellation writing. You can't just make it up and do it ad hoc. Like, and his grandfather, his temples and his palace has what looks like constellation images as a form of writing. So it's the idea of the wordplay as revelation, you know. So when you find a pun in a constellation title, when you find a secondary meaning, you found new information about that constellation, that divine being that's up there in the stars doing something. So the idea, I just always like this one because it resonates. Most people in America, if they haven't been raised in a tradition foundation, they're familiar with the idea that at some point, you know, in Matthew's gospel, Jesus says to Peter, he says, you are rock, you're Petros, rock. And on this rock, I'm going to build my church, right? And the Roman Catholic Church identifies this as the the foundation for the papal office. So our Pope, you know, the Catholic Pope is based on a pun. That's pretty serious when you think about it. You know, it's not George Carlin stuff. It's, you know, it's serious wordplay. Because it was believed
that around the word rock and ancient words for rock is also a really big part of this story too.
Yes. Yeah.
And you know, we're going to see that word, sir, show up in this EQ decode.
Yeah.
And you know, that was, for example, Phoenicia, the capital of Phoenicia for a time was the city Sir, which is spelled for some reason in English, T-Y-R-E. So most people are saying tire, but it's Sir. So that's rock, that's Lord, that's the head, you know, it's the Latin Petros. Yeah. But that word, the rock is super important for, you know, the rock star. That's the king or the savior or the Messiah or the head priest.
Yeah. Yeah. So Sela, the term Sela comes up in Aramaic. Sela, I believe, means rock. So another thing that starts to show up with these Amanu and especially with the astrologers is... references, you'll see the term amatnitzirti, hidden words, and then connected to some idea of perishtu shaili, which means secrets of the gods. They're tipping their hands. They're saying, they're writing back and forth for each other, but they're saying, yeah, you find a hidden word, you find a pun, you find a homonym, a homophone, synonym, or double entendre, and you found a secret of a deity that no one else knew about. And it's important. So when you find one, you keep it secret. The uninitiated shall not know this. This is secret information amongst the Amanu, the scholars, right? So one of the great scholars of punning in the ancient world is Scott Nogle. And I'm just going to just read the major stuff here. So the earliest writing is cuneiform. And part of the reason that punning was so important, and it's that writing was considered of a divine origin. Puns provided the diviners with interpretive strategies, and those diviners included the astrologers. Words were considered the embodiment of the object or the idea they represented. We think of it as DNA, but in the ancient world, it was actually the name itself. That's why it was, when you were given a name, it was a characteristic of who you were and who your personality was.
Yeah, in the version of the system, they called the name the Ren. It's your Ren, which is a layer of your body. It's actually one of the bodies that you
exist
within simultaneously, layers of the shell.
It very interesting. Yeah. And that makes perfect sense. And when it gets to cuneiform, it's from the idea, well, you see it in Hebrew as well. And, you know, all the biblical languages, but individual words contain the power of essence. And what's crucial here is there was a whole envelope of information that came with every cuneiform sign or part of a word. We don't have that. That's the stuff that's always so hard to explain. And I just do my best. And so where it comes from is the idea that the reason cuneiform writing is so polysemous is because, you know, cuneiform writing is invented by the Sumerians and around 3000 BC. And they've got kingdoms throughout southern Mesopotamia. And there's this constant influx of these Akkadian-speaking peoples that we later know as the Babylonians of southern Mesopotamia and the Assyrians of northern Mesopotamia. So they end up living with the Sumerians and in fact, kind of overtaking the Sumerians to the point where Sumerian dies as a spoken language at about, I don't know, 1800 BC. And then from that point on, it's retained as the sacred language of science and literature. But the Akkadian-speaking peoples retain Sumerian in their everyday writing through these things called Sumerian logograms. And again, there's just not many analogies. So I'll give it a shot here. So there's about 600 signs in the cuneiform writing system, right? And everyone has a sign name, just like the letter A, B, C. The letter B says B, but the name is B, right? The letter A is named A, but it says A. They have 600 of those. And the difference is they have different readings. So this is just one of the more popular ones. An just means, in Sumerian, it means sky. And it can also be read Dingir, which just means deity or god. So the Babylonians and the Assyrians, the Akkadian speakers, they adopt this Sumerian writing system, and they retain thousands and thousands of words using Sumerian logograms. Here's our closest analogy.
And then you have On is the solar deity at Heliopolis.
And you have that. And I'm sure there's a connection to that. There's no way that's accidental, you know. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is, like, when they borrow it, so they have this one cuneiform sign. So you can read it. So An means Shamu in Akkadian, which is skies or heavens, and Ilu in Akkadian, which is, you know, God. Okay, so like, well, that's not too hard. Like, I can get that. And then you realize that these Sumerian Akkadian dictionaries just list Sumerian logogram, thousands of them, and all their meanings. So An can mean Shamu, skies, heavens. It can mean Yau, which means mine or belonging to me. It can mean Kakabu, which is star. It can mean Shibultu, ear barley. It can mean Zukupu, which means to impale, you know, to impale someone on a stake. Can mean Sha, which is of, can mean Asaku, taboo. It can also mean Ilu, of course, God. And so when you write that one cuneiform sign, you can get skies, heavens, mind, star, barley, ear, impaling, of, taboo, and God. That's polysemy. That's what I'm trying to convey.
Yeah, can I offer, this is just conjecture on my part, but let me offer possible, you know, pathway how it got so convoluted would be perhaps that you have priests acting, you know, in their capacity in different areas that are sharing these language groups, and they're not connected by instantaneous communication or an internet. You know, they have to walk to each other or ride horses. It's not a quick informational transit from one area to another. So at the point where you're doing your scribe thing, and it's not easy or simple to chisel or, you know, impress into the clay this particular style of writing. So you're going to constantly be trying to think of ways to quicken it. Yeah. So one temple might come up with a usage of the On cuneiform logogram and symbol, and then another one might come up with what they're using as an abbreviation with that exact same symbol. And then later priests, generations later, potentially, they have these old lexicons and dictionaries, and it's just kind of snowballed, and they're accepting all the things that the forefathers said one thing meant as true. Sure. And just trying to keep compiling and keep track of it all, you know?
Yeah.
So it just got bigger and bigger and snowballed more and more.
Yeah, and then around 1600 BC, they're trying to preserve Sumerian. So they start to make these Sumerian Akkadian dictionaries, is the only word that comes to mind. Maybe you could think of it as a thesaurus, maybe. But so then there's a zillions of homophones. So there's so many homophones that, like, you have to, the transliteration scheme, there's so many cuneiform signs that, instead of trying to memorize 600 of them, scholars just use, you end up being an expert in a certain area of, you know, cuneiform writing. So they use little numbers so you know which cuneiform sign's written on a tablet. So the most common cuneiform sign for Mul, which just means star in Sumerian. It could mean constellation if you wanted it to. Mul, there's a Mul 2, a Mul 3, a Mul 4, a Mul 5, and Mul X. Mul X is the astrologer's esoteric form. Mul just means Kakabu in Akkadian. It means star. You could also register it as a constellation, right? Well, the problem is that that's not too bad, but every one of those cuneiform signs has other readings. And I'm only giving you two. Like, there's some of them have like 10, and they might have 50 words attached to them. So when you write a constellation, remember, every star in the sky starts with one of these Mul signs. And you can just start to see the level of polysemy embedded in every constellation title. You know, Mul Neshu, which is, you know, the lion, you know, constellation lion. There might be 30 words embedded in that. Okay, and then just giving you an example. So when you write the cuneiform sign mul, those little numbers, don't worry about them. They're for they're so linguists and archaeologists know which cuneiform sign's being written. But so when you write mul, the Sumerian word spoken mul that means star or constellation, it can mean star, god, shining brightly, inscription, writing, arrow, foundation, ornament, piece, wood wasp, water course, distant time, fruit, feeling elated, field, cow, moon, and month. That's one. So I'm not trying to.
Well, it's awesome though, is to just like looking at that list, you can come up with reasons how all those ideas relate to stars.
Yeah. And,
interestingly enough, like there is some kind of, you know, as metaphysical, allegorical relationship to all those things being constellations or stars as well. Yeah. Thinking of like the fruit, the stars are like the fruit of the, you know, the tree of life that is the pole of the world, and the North Star being the top and all that.
Yeah. In fact, one of the titles for the moon is Inbu, which is fruit. It's the Akkadian word for fruit. So, yeah. And again, if you find a pun, the secret of the great gods, the uninitiated shall not see it. Right. So the, where they really Enumalish, the creation story, Enumalish, tablet 7, that's where they show you. They don't show you. They don't tell you. It's all secret. But when you see what they're doing, that's what explains how they use wordplay to unpack as a form of revelation. So they lift. So the god Marduk. Marduk is the planet Jupiter. His aspect is Jupiter. He's the supreme Babylonian deity. He's got 50 Sumerian titles, 50 epithets, and they're written in as Sumerian logograms. And they used these 50 epithets. They found wordplay in them to construct all 163 lines of Enumalish Tablet 7. And it's very tangible, is the best way, palpable, to see how they did it. And I'll just give you one example. So Enumalish Tablet 7, line 128, it says, the god Nibiru is hit. There's no word for being in Akkadian, so you have to always insert the word for being, like is. His star, which in the skies they cause to appear, right? So that's how they write it in cuneiform, right? Mul Din Gir Nibiru. My formatting got messed up there. So the star god Nibiru just means crossing. It's when Marduk Jupiter is crossing the middle of the sky. So that's why it has the epithet Nibiru, crossing the fjord, you could think of it as.
So I hear New Agers being like, but it's planet X and it will bring the apocalypse.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't think Zachariah Sitchin's is on the table for this examination.
Yeah, no,
I'm not a fan personally.
Yeah, no, I get people that email me about that. So so one of the ways to write, you know, Nibiru is, you know, it's a deity. So it's Din Gir Nibiru. That's how you spell it. Netubiru, right? That's how you spell Nibiru. The little numbers aren't there though. So, and you could use the mul 2 sign. Remember, you have, you know, six different mul signs to choose from, right? So one of them's mul. So literally it says the star god Nibiru, the star god crossing, right? Well, mul 2 has a whole bunch of different meanings other than just star. One of them is Ushapu, which means they cause to appear, okay? Din Gir, as we saw earlier, can mean Ilu god, it can mean Kakabu star, and it can also be read An, which is skies. The Ne number 2 sign doesn't seem to be used in this pun. B can be read, it literally is the word for his in Sumerian logogram, for his in Akkadian means Shu. Ru stands for the word Sha, which is which, and Ina, which is in. And then they just took those words and made a coherent sentence. The god crossing is his star, which in the skies they cause to appear. My formatting got messed up a little bit when I pulled this up. So that's how they did it. So I just was like, well, you know, I may be Polish, but I think I can figure this one out. I bet they're doing that with the other myths, you know? So one of the things, one of the greatest Near Eastern scholars of our times, this guy, A.R. George, right? He died recently. One of the things he says is, in the ancient cuneiform scholarship, the writing of a name can be adapted to impart information about the nature and function of its bearer. Babylonian scholars, he's talking about astrologers and all the Umana, right? Themselves were fond of the speculative interpretation of names in particular. This was not a trivial pursuit, but a means of revealing profound truth about the nature and function of the deities and their attributes. And not only that, what they did, what made them so special. So now all this starts. So what does Mesopotamian Lamashi writing and wordplay and punning in Enumerlish Tablet 7 got to do with Hesiod, the first Greek author to mention Pegasus? Well, you know, there's a guy named, is it Peter Walcott? I believe it's Peter Walcott. He wrote a tome on Hesiod's writings, especially Theogony. And he says it has striking parallels in Akkadian and Hittite texts and seems originally to have come from the Near East. And he also writes its closest companion, you know, he's talking about Theogony here, right? Theogony. Its closest companions in Greek literature are the Homeric hymns, but even closer is the picture of Zeus in the Theogony and that of Marduk in the Enumerlish, and is to Babylonian tradition in the 8th century BC that we should resort if we wish to assess Hesiod's debt to the Near East. He says, Theogony is based on Enumerlish, is what he's saying, you know. So hostage astrologers.
And right? It might be, or it might be that both were based on the same constellation writing.
And it could be.
You know, I think I kind of see it that way, like, because, again, there wasn't mass transit of information. You had to get on a boat or ride a horse or walk. So, yeah. You know, I think it made more sense to train the priests who were probably in contact with each other loosely. And, you know, like the Masons, for example, currently, one thing that they call themselves and each other is travelers. Okay. Because I think that this, you know, priesthood and temple building, they were the same guild, you know, along with probably navigators, sailors, all part of the same trade secrets because they're all related to the sky, knowledge of the sky and wisdom.
So intimate knowledge.
So I think that we're seeing probably, you know, we're trying to say which one was the original, who's basing what on who, but I think it simplifies the whole equation to just say they're using the same type of methodology and they're using the same text that they're translating from, the text being the sky, the methodology being puns and polysemy of their own languages.
Where it shows up, you talk about hostage astrologers. Daniel is definitely a hostage astrologer. He's taken by Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar II. It even says in verse 5:11 that he comes to be the supervisor of all the astrologers and all of the magicians of Babylonia. Pliny the Elder talks about slaves being taken overseas. And that Manilius Antiochus is the originator of our astronomy. He's one of the slaves. He came from Syria, which is, you know, the Phoenician coast. Zenodotus of Malos tells us that Homer was a Babylonian. He's writing in the first century BC. And here's where it gets funny. So the name Homer means hostage. That's what his name is. And so he twice describes seagoing Phoenician slave traders in his writings in the Iliad. And the Homeric hymns recount how the god Dionysius was taken by pirates as booty while walking on the beach. They were going to sell him for a ransom, right? So, and, you know, there's a Near Eastern archaeologist named Bradley Parker, and he identifies Tiglath-Pileser. He's an 8th century Assyrian king. He talks about, you know, some of these Phoenician cities were under the rule of the Assyrians in the 8th century, and they're having all these problems with these Greeks coming in and taking slaves, just raiding their port cities, taking as many slaves as they can, and then booking out. That was the goal. It wasn't to, like, overthrow the city or try to take its wealth. It was to get as much booty as possible, and one of the best forms of booty was slaves. And in a mock interview, Lucian has a mock interview with Homer, and he says to him, above all, he says, where do you come from? He's talking to Homer, and Homer says, as a matter of fact, I'm a Babylonian, and among my fellow countrymen, my name was not Homer, but Tigranes. later on, when I was a hostage, Homer, among the Greeks, I changed my name. So his name is literally eponymous. And he's saying, my name's based on who I am. I'm a hostage.
You know, Lucian also interestingly calls the Phoenician capital shifted. I don't remember chronologically which was the more prominent city first. We have Sur, which is spelled T-Y-R-E, and then you have Byblos, okay, the city of the book. Mm-hmm. Maybe even once we get the word Bible, for all we know. But Lucian called Byblos Gabala, which is literally the word Kabbalah, but with a G. G and C interchange all the time, especially with Greek writers. So, and then in the, I think Latin it is, Kabbalus is a horse. So we know Kabbalah represents a secret initiatory stream of knowledge and information based largely on arithmetic and astrology and the doctrine of emanations, similar to Buddhism and other Eastern things as well. So the fact that we're saying that, you know, this Phoenician capital, Byblos, the book, city of the book, is Kabbalah or Kabbalah. You know, that's Kabbalah, cube. I've heard a lot of esotericists call it cube Bala. Yeah. You know, because the word book backwards phonetically is actually cube.
Interesting.
So we're talking about this square in the sky that is basically a book that has all these, you know, Pegasus related and other and biblical stories and Quran stories coming from a horse that is also a book. It's Kabbalah or Gabbalah, you know? So,
Again, I'm sure there's a connection, but a great classical scholar named M.L. West just said it outright. He just said that there was no Homer. It was a historical poet. He wasn't a historical poet. He was a fictitious constructed name. There's no original Homer. The Hermoradidae were not named after a person, but not knowing any better, they invented a Homer as their ancestor or founder.
Greeks loved to do. Yeah. You know, they would like pick a whatever the name of a people or a group was. They had a story where those people had an ancestor whose name their group derived their title from. You know, commonplace.
Yeah, and I'm saying that Homer is actually probably a Babylonian or an Assyrian, that he was maybe a Babylonian astrologer. New Lamashi writing was taken captive, brought to the Greeks, learned Greek, and then taught this system directly to the Greeks. And all of a sudden you have an alphabetic writing. You have Greek. You have the Greek myths showing up, you know, starting with Homer and Hesiod.
Well, that might have something related to the whole mythos of Cadmus, which bringing the alphabet to the Greeks, which is the same 16-letter alphabet as the Phoenician, the ancient Celts, other groups as well. That those 16 letters are in a similar order. Hebrew QDM, which is like Cadmus, is also East. You know, so something from the East coming and teaching these letters.
Yeah. So, and Walter Burkert, an outstanding scholar. He was actually a friend of the professor who taught me Akkadian. And he said, you know, I mean, you've got cuneiform tablets, you've got, you know, Aramaic, and you've got Greek all side by side in places that aren't anywhere near Mesopotamia. And you've in Italy, even as far as Italy, you know. So he said, there's no other way to say it other than Greek literary practice is ultimately dependent on Mesopotamia. And I'm trying to condense because I have a lot of slides. So I'm trying to get to some of the takeaway of all this is simply that there's archaeological and textual record documents direct contact between Mesopotamia and Greek scholars throughout the 8th century BC. The ancient record implies that a Babylonian tupshadu or astrologer had been taken hostage by a Hellenic satrap, right? And Lucian claims that a vestige of the slave-taking encounter remains in the eponymous title of the father of Greek epic poetry, Homer, hostage. He was a Babylonian hostage. That's my theory on how it happens, right?
I'm throwing a lot of monkey wrenches in, but I want to also say that, you know, that there's a lot of confusion with I mean, I'm not saying I have the answer, but that there's place names that get repeated. you know, there's Rome is called Babylon in the Bible, for example. And there are multiple versions of the same name showing up. I actually want to read a little bit from Godfrey Higgins' Anacalypsis, where he says the author of Nimrod has shown that Babylon was built with a tower in the middle of it and square. And there's a square, a tower in the middle, in imitation of Meru or the Indian city or their Ararat, Mount Ararat, where the ark lands, surrounded by streets making seven concentric squares of houses and seven spaces and 28 principal streets, like the seven lands and seas of Meru, and the eighth, the outward foss or Oceanus. He has shown that the tower was formed upon seven towers, one above another, exactly as the Indian priest taught, and imagined that the world was formed on belts of land and sea, step by step, to the Meru or North Pole in the center at the top. Here appears to be a complete jumble of astronomy and mythology. The seven seas and Mount of the North, Isaiah's seat of the gods, were theological. The seven planets, astrological, and concealed from the vulgar. So he goes on to talk about how the author of Nimrod claims that Meru or the mountain is surrounded by paradise. And again, it has that square around the tower type of structure. You know, this is very much in line with the mythos of the Garden of Eden originating in the Pegasus Square. And then various places you have in many, many places, religious groves or gardens are where the priests or the initiated will meet and hang out, groves and gardens. And I think this comes from the supposition that Meru was attached to paradise. You have the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, Antioch, Syria. In Syria, was built on seven hills. So was Rome. The Gardens of Adonis at Byblos had this similar structure of like stacking things on each other, according to the, you know, the texts that I've read. I've never been there and I don't have a time travel machine, but I just find it fascinating. And, you know, that it's worth questioning the reason why there's more than one Babylon, more than one Troy, more than one Zion, in that they proceed perhaps from a superstitious imitation of the idea of the first or original city. And also that when we're talking about flood mythos in particular, it's not necessarily recognized that the Genesis creation story is actually the Noah's Ark flood mythos. Even though they don't look the same on the surface level, we're talking about the creator God basically bringing humanity back. You know, it's replenish. It's not like the first time that this happened. So, you know, we have... This is one of the common themes, maybe most common themes that all mythos sort of spirals out of. This protagonist or first father, Adam, Noah, different versions of him, who all humanity issues from, and his wife, Eve, who is also in other sense, the androgynous other half of the one being. So it gets confusing in that, you know, the idea was that every regeneration and every cycle, the exact things might happen again the exact way they happened before. So the story of Troy meaning three, by the way, Trinity, is going to repeat in exact detail in the future. So in that sense, the judicial astrology idea of reading the future and being able to read the past, in a bizarre paradox, they're actually the same thing, the future and the past.
Yeah. And I think, Chance, also there's the idea of celestial geography. So that's another piece to this, that certain constellations represent certain places on Earth. And you would have stories attached to those places, and they might be different stories about the same place. You know, I don't know. I just a thought as you were
talking. That's in the mix for sure.
Yeah.
So I want to, John, I think we're getting ready to start getting into the nitty gritty on some of the Lumashi in the Pegasus Square. Lots of great buildup for that. Can we wrap up on this slide? And if there's any other in between starting the Pegasus Square decode proper, I want to do our intermission and then come back, if that's okay. We're roughly a little more than halfway through the slide. So it seems like a good point.
Great.
Yeah. So just maybe wrap up this slide and then we'll give your plugs and stuff, and then we'll do our intermission.
Yeah. So the idea that the Mesopotamian idea that the sky was a hallowed text that imparted revelation through wordplay, that's what the Sumerian astrologers understood. Sumerian and Babylonian and Syrian astrologers, Mesopotamian astrologers saw that as the vehicle of explaining deep history, mythical history, archetypal history. And they conceptualized the constellations as heavenly writing that framed monumental historic events whose details were imparted through wordplay encrypted in the constellations' cuneiform spellings. And I'm suggesting that that's the cipher which allows us to discern the astronomical origin of Pegasus and the myth recounting its birth. So.
Very cool. Is that do you think this is a good?
Yeah.
Cool. I think so too. Good stopping point for, we'll take about a 3-minute intermission, play some music, get up, go to the restroom, get some drinks. And, we're going to continue the conversation not on YouTube, but we will continue streaming on Rockfin. My Patreon will also receive the second hour of this chat. So hop on over. Rockfin's really worth, joining, becoming a member of. They do such a better job supporting the content creators than YouTube does. Would love to see. I know a lot of you will be there. Some of you are already transitioning over. Thanks for hanging out on the YouTube side. John, can you remind them all how they can connect with you, what work you have available for them to check out, and any other closing thoughts for the first half of the conversation so far? I mean, it feels like we were just building up to help everyone have a strong ability to conceive of the logic and what we're really here to talk about, which is all these different iterations of mythos in the Pegasus Square. Super excited to get into that more granular aspect of the talk. Let them know where they can get your work, buddy.
Yeah. So the books, The Celestial Code of Scripture, you can, The Astral Cipher Underlying the Miracle Stories of the Bible, the Quran, you can get it at Amazon. You can also look up the Utah Cultural Astronomy Project, which was founded by my co-researcher named John Lundvall. And he's got some incredible video up regarding the Native American archaeoastronomy and astral theology and the places that we go and we study and we visit, mostly connected to rock art here in Utah.
I'd love to get into that in a future talk. That's something I don't know as much about. Ironically, that's way closer to me geographically than all this European Middle Eastern stuff.
Yeah. My pleasure.
All right. Well, thanks for, thanks for being here. Hopefully it's okay with you that we might go a little longer to get through all the slides, but I'm so excited for all the great material you prepared for us. Extremely good introduction or refresher for those who are already familiar with it in this first half. And we'll see everybody over on Rockfin. John, thanks for being here, and we'll be back after a couple minutes of intermission.
Great.
Says 6 minutes. Middle music, but we'll be back in about three.